having business before the Honorable Supreme Court of Texas are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the state of Texas and this honorable court.
Thank you. Be seated. This morning, the court has three matters on its oral submission docket. They are Keck, Malin, and Kate, Grant Cook, and Robert Forsala versus National Union Fire Insurance Company of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, from Harris County. Waco Independent School District versus Lester and Coach Gibson and others from McLennan County. And the Bland Independent School District and others versus Douglas and Carolyn Blue from Hunt County. In each of these causes, the court has permitted each side to make argument for 20 minutes. Petitioners may reserve a portion of that time for rebuttal by advising our marshal. We will take a break in between the presentation of each argument and conclude these arguments before lunch. If you wish to purchase a tape of any argument, you may make application with our clerk and buy a tape for a nominal fee. The court is ready to hear argument from petitioners in Keck, Malin, and Kate versus National Union.
May it please the court, counsel, it is my great pleasure to represent Houston lawyers Grant Cook, Robert Plasala, and their law firm Keck, Main & Kate. It is also a true privilege for me to present the first argument to this court in the new millennium. In this case, Keck, Main & Kate seeks reversal of the judgment of the Court of Appeals on two issues. I'll briefly address the release issue, and then I'll turn to the comparative responsibility issue associated with the equitable subrogation claim. The judgment of the Court of Appeals, with all due respect, should be reversed and a take-nothing judgment rendered in favor of Keck, Main & Kate because the Court of Appeals erred in its construction of the release. First, by nullifying language in paragraphs 2 and 5 of the release, the Court of Appeals violated every cardinal rule of contract construction from this court. The release was found by the trial court, Judge Link, to be unambiguous. The Court of Appeals, therefore, could not read language or write language out of the instrument, and it did so when it ignored the any and all claims language in paragraphs 2 and 5.
Even if that were the case, how would you differentiate conduct that occurred after the April 1, 92 date?
The parties used the April 1, 1992 date as a mechanism to draw a line between their past conduct, which they were seeking to release, and their future relationship, which was not part of the release. The language in paragraph 2 that says, Granada releases Keck, Main, and Kate for any and all claims, causes of action, associated directly or indirectly attributable to legal services rendered before April 1. That's the language the parties chose to achieve a release of any legal malpractice claim that might accrue later, but arose directly or indirectly out of legal services rendered before April 1. Because the parties knew at the time that the discovery rule in Texas governing accrual of legal malpractice claims, because of that rule, it was possible that although conduct occurred before April 1, the cause of action might not accrue until later. The language actually used by the parties in paragraph 2 that says claims now existing or that might arise hereafter indicates the party's intention to release claims that might accrue in the future.
Well, but listen, weren't there about 3 weeks between April 1 and the start of trial?
That's correct.
And if the allegation is a failure to properly prepare for trial, then how can you divorce it from those 3 weeks before trial with typically intense preparation? I mean, I don't know how to divide that line.
The line is divided this way. The very specific allegations of malpractice made by National Union against Keck, Main, and Kate, both in its pleading and in the deposition testimony of its expert, Martin Mayo, each and every one of those acts specifically alleged all fall before April 1, 1992. And so, in the first instance, that the fact that there's actually deposition testimony of National Union's own expert witness to the effect that all of those alleged acts of malpractice occurred before April 1 extinguishes the claim. There was some discussion by the Court of Appeals.
But what is the harm that occurs at that point in time? I thought the alleged harm here was that the law firm was not prepared to try the lawsuit, and the trial occurred after the ending date that's stated in the release. Didn't the harm occur to the insured at the point in time the lawyers went to trial unprepared, allegedly?
Your Honor, certain rules of accrual with respect to legal malpractice claims say that the injury occurs when the advice is taken. Under the discovery rule, the cause of action may not accrue until much later, until the harm is actually discovered. But in this case, because of the broad language actually used by the parties in paragraph 2 of the release, it indicates the parties were intending to release claims whether they were known or unknown or whether they had not accrued yet. And while it may be true that the cause of action may have accrued later and the harm may have been suffered later, the fact is that by the use of the language, claims that now exist or that may hereafter accrue, that indicates the party's intention as of April 1, 1992, to extinguish those claims, though they may not accrue until later, and though the harm may not accrue until later. Let me move briefly to the final error committed by the Court of Appeals, and that is with respect to the construction of the release. The court improperly found that that unless a claim is expressly enumerated in a release instrument, the claim cannot be extinguished. That is inconsistent with this court's recent opinion in Memorial Medical Center versus Kessler. And in that regard, Your Honor, the Court of Appeals simply erred. It is indeed possible, as this court well knows, to extinguish liability for claims, though they are not expressly enumerated in the release instrument. Release instruments are drawn every day that don't contain a catalog of each and every cause of action the parties seek to extinguish. If, as the court will see from Exhibit 1, Petitioner's Exhibit 1, a comparison of the language actually used by the parties in their release instrument, paragraphs 2 and 5, to the way the Court of Appeals and National Union read the release instrument shows the manner in which the language, certain language, has been nullified in violation of this court's opinion in Kessler, and other words have actually been added to paragraphs 2 and 5 to limit the scope of the release, and that's where the court erred. Moving now to the issue of comparative responsibility.
Let me ask you one more thing about the release. Even if everything you say is true, since this release is between an attorney and client, the attorney presently representing, doesn't it have to be put through a rather higher filter under our concept of fiduciary duties to show that the client was fully apprised of the full nature of what they were waiving in exchange for the attorney's fees being forgiven?
I understand the question from the court, and the answer is that in this case, the Tech Main and Cape and its client Granada did fulfill that test. The recital, the fourth recital in the release, where the parties recite, both parties recite, that the law firm, Tech Main and Cape, had advised its client Granada separately in writing that it may be appropriate to seek independent representation in connection with the release. That, Your Honor, fulfills the obligation to make sure that this is a proper instrument. Moving now, if I've answered the court's questions.
And is that separate writing in the record, or is that an attorney?
It is not in the record, Your Honor, and I would add one more point on that. The issue the court raised in its question was not raised in the trial court. There are no pleadings whatsoever by National Union in that regard. Moving now to the issue of the comparative responsibility, Tech Main and Cape also seeks a reversal and a remand by this court of the judgment of the Court of Appeals. When this court in American Centennial created for the very first time the right, the limited right of a non-client insurance company to sue a lawyer for legal malpractice, the court was striving to correct a perceived injustice and to achieve fairness. Most importantly, It was striving to equitably redistribute the losses to the party whose conduct caused the loss. But in doing that, this court said, by doing so, we will not expand the liability of lawyers beyond the duties they owe to their clients. Those two fundamental tenets of American Centennial both have been violated by the Court of Appeals opinion. First and foremost, Keck, Mayne, and Tate seeks to introduce into evidence the entire spectrum of National Union's conduct. It wants the jury to hear the facts.
And what is your legal theory that underpins your argument?
First, Your Honor, the first justification for the introduction of the full spectrum of National Union's conduct is the fact that a majority of this court in American Centennial, in the concurrence, signaled that the lawyer...
Now, tell me what your legal theory is that underpins that in an equitable subordination action like this one, that the full range of conduct of the excess carrier should be admissible and considered by the fact finder.
Equity requires that it be considered for the proximate cause consideration. Equity requires it, and authority from this court suggests that it's appropriate.
The court in American Centennial rejected giving the excess carrier a direct action against the lawyer, correct?
That is correct.
What is the nature in Texas law, then, of an equitable subordination action as the court recognized in American Centennial?
The theory is that the subrogee is allowed to step into the shoes of the subrogor to recover for loss that it paid on behalf of the subrogor.
And so what rights and defenses are then available to the parties in an equitable subordination action?
In a typical equitable subordination suit, the defendant in the subrogee action inherits the defenses that could have been asserted by the original asserted against the subrogor.
All right, so you're asking us then to expand beyond equitable subordination law in Texas when you ask us to allow the defendant to pursue any defenses that may arise out of the conduct of the subrogee. That's an expansion of the law of equitable subordination in Texas, and doesn't it make it more like a direct action than it does an equitable subordination action?
To the extent that the court does not consider the view of the majority of the court, of this court in the American Centennial
Court. I just want to talk to you about equitable subordination law. I understand that there's a debate between the parties of what that concurring opinion means. I just want to talk to you generally about equitable subordination law. So putting aside what that separate opinion meant, aren't you in fact then making this more like a direct action by an excess carrier than you are an equitable subordination action?
It does represent an expansion from the traditional doctrine of equitable subrogation.
And then doesn't it fall in the category of making it a direct action?
I don't believe so, Your
Honor. Why not?
Because the conduct that Keck, Mayne, and Tate seeks to introduce about National Union is National Union's own action. In a direct action against the law firm, I guess the court's point is that the same evidence would come in, and so therefore it's analogous to a direct
action.
But
the only reason why National Union can sue is because it has a right to equitable subordination, which means its rights arise vis-a-vis the insured and the insured's relationship with the attorney.
That is the theory as articulated.
Otherwise, National Union can't come to court.
That is the theory articulated in American Centennial.
Okay,
that's correct.
So why what I'm trying to do is understand if this court has rejected the viability of a direct action, or at least in American Centennial refused to go that far, then how do you get around the equitable subordination construct that is in place under Texas law to ask us to make additional defenses available to the law firm that arise from National Union's conduct when in fact National Union is only suing as a subrogee?
Because it goes to the point of proximate cause. National Union comes to this court and says, the conduct of Keck, Mayne, and Tate caused this loss that I had to pay out of my pocket. When National Union goes to court and seeks to recover that loss, attacking the conduct of another party, saying the conduct of Keck, Mayne, and Tate caused that loss.
So you're asking us then to looking at the first opinion in American Centennial, we would have to go back and rework that opinion to really, in fact, acknowledge some sort of modified direct action then. At least a modified version of a direct action. It's not truly an equitable subordination claim anymore, is it?
It is not. It is not. And I believe that this court, in at least a majority of the members of this court, in the concurrence in American Centennial, signaled and recognized that there could be times when the conduct of the excess carrier contributes to the loss that it is then seeking to recover.
But only if there's a duty. And isn't that what the whole question depends on, is that the Court of Appeals seemed to draw a bright line test on duty, which has some appeal because it is bright line and pretty simple to apply. Once you get beyond that bright line test, where do you then draw the line?
Let me answer that question, though I realize I'm out of time. The distinction made by the Court of Appeals based on the MSCOR case, I believe, goes too far, because the duty there that in MSCOR was precluded was the duty to defend. MSCOR said only that the excess carrier has no duty to defend or no duty to actually pay its policy limits until the primary has exhausted. Here, we are not asking, we're not criticizing National Union for failing in its duty to defend or its duty to settle. We're criticizing National Union for duties far more basic and fundamental, for violating their own internal operating procedures that require the company to read its policy and reserve its rights and
so
monitor the claim.
So you say these duties can arise before there's ever any demand from a plaintiff in the underlying lawsuit?
We do, Your Honor.
Then aren't you asking us to again make a change in fundamental Texas law regarding the duties that excess carriers owe?
To the extent that the court considers MSCOR to represent the law in Texas, yes, in a very narrow way. It goes to the problem of proximate cause, because National Union, having violated its own internal operating procedures, arrived at trial, frankly, claiming to be surprised and caught off guard.
If you ask us to impose additional duties on excess carriers, as I believe you're asking us to impose additional duties then, beyond what exists in Texas law now. Correct.
To the extent that the court considers MSCOR to represent the law, which this court has never cited it for that purpose.
Are you saying that excess carriers owe the same duties that primary carriers do?
No, Your Honor.
What is the difference in your construct then between what a primary carrier owes with respect to duties to its insured as opposed to an excess carrier?
The primary carrier owes the duty to defend, which is the paramount duty and the paramount obligation. The primary carrier owes the duty to settle. And to manage the claim properly. Distinct from those responsibilities, however, are the duties that we submit the excess carrier has to pay attention, to observe the claim, and when liability under its policy becomes apparent, it has some responsibility. Even though the primary carrier has not tendered, it has some responsibility to exercise due care in managing the liability to its insured, even to it, and its own exposure.
Isn't your whole concept in tension with our notion that the underlying attorney owes a primary, essentially sole duty of care to their client, and they make certain decisions, and the insurance company stays out, which is an outgrowth of the Tilly Doctrine that we discussed in Traylor? And how can that work if not only the primary carrier is supervising to the extent they have to, but we have various levels of excess calling the shots in the case at the risk of being denied any right to recover if there's malpractice?
If I understand the court's question.
Wasn't very well phrased.
I believe I followed that. I may not have. But if I did, I suggest this, that the excess carrier can take the basic fundamental steps necessary to be prepared on the day the primary carrier tenders, even if that is after judgment. But it doesn't necessarily have to be so involved in the defense of the case, and we're not urging that it do it. We're not suggesting that National Union should have actually been in monitoring and second-guessing the decisions of defense counsel in trial. We are simply saying that National Union should have been aware enough of the claim, its own policy, whether any of the claims were covered. It should have responded to settlement demands that it received within its policy limits. It should have reserved its rights so that on the day it arrived at trial, when the primary tendered for the very first time, National Union was not caught unawares. And that's exactly what happened here. Its executives had no idea about this claim. And so, Your Honor, in answering your question, we are not suggesting that the excess carrier take on the day-to-day responsibilities of the defense. Not at all.
Well, who was responsible for this? Was Keck responsible for representing the client, or was National Union responsible for representing the client?
Keck, Maine, and Kate owed a duty solely to Granada to represent it in the trial.
And if they did it reasonably, then that's the end of this, the issue, isn't it?
I submit respect.
What is it that National Union should have done? What duty did they owe to Keck to make sure Keck was being reasonable?
Your Honor, they didn't owe a duty to Keck. They owed a duty to their insured to make sure that they understood the claim properly so that on the day that National Union took over the settlement, it was informed enough to be able to make a reasonable settlement. The theory of the case that we want the jury to be able to hear
is... So this is a Stowers case against National Union?
To some degree, yes. But
And you did suggest in your brief the possibility of imposing a Stowers obligation upon an excess carrier under Texas law.
We have suggested that, although we don't think it's necessary to do that to justify the admission of this evidence. Your Honor, the problem was National Union arrived at the trial completely uninformed about the merits of the case. It woke up to the fact that it had not reserved its rights and it had not responded to two settlement demands. That motivated it to pay $7 million to limit its own liability for an excess judgment. In the time frame in which this case was taking place, 1991 and 1992, pre-Garcia, National Union understood at that moment that it faced liability for an excess judgment. It was unprepared to respond when the primary carrier tendered. We want to show the jury, as part of the proximate cause analysis, that that position that National Union found itself in, having nothing to do with the actions of defense counsel.
That's Stowers.
It is Stowers. It was the fear.
Is there any other duty in Texas that an insured has against the insurance company in this context other than Stowers?
No, sir. Not any other common law duty. But it was that motivation that we think caused National Union to pay the amount that it did. And we believe that by depriving the jury of the opportunity to hear that evidence, it will result in a completely distorted proximate cause analysis of whose conduct caused the loss. And that's exactly what this court was striving to do in American Centennial, was to distribute the loss to the party whose conduct caused it.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from respondent.
May it please the court. Mr. Kevin Jewell will now present argument from respondent National Union Fire Insurance Company, and Mr. Kirk Pages will present argument from respondent Insurance Company North America. Mr. Jewell will open with the first 14 minutes.
May it please the court. It is a pleasure today, this morning, to be presenting argument on behalf of National Union in this case. We submit that, in fact, to agree with Keck's position on the comparative fault issue, the court will have to fundamentally alter not only existing Texas law about the nature of equitable subrogation, but also the fundamental relationship that exists between primary and excess carriers.
Are your damages liquidated in the underlying suit, or is it only your fault after April 1 or after the date you were? What do you envision based on the Court of Appeals remand that the proof would look like at trial on damages?
Well, the damages issue, as I understand it, National Union would have to prove, I guess, establish the difference between what it paid to settle the case versus what it would have paid had there been but for the negligence of the firm and the primary carrier.
How about your conduct? Does that come in there at all?
It does not come in until after the date that the primary limits were tendered. And that's consistent with Texas authority, and that's exactly what the court...
What effect is the fact that the record indicates that $3.6 million demand was made and transmitted to your client, but nothing happened. Didn't that put them on notice that there's something going on that's going to implicate them in this case, and they need to be involved?
It does not in this case, because that demand, the most recent demand, came in February of 92. And after that demand was communicated by Annette Hartford at INA to National Union, there was another communication to National Union that, in fact, the primary carrier intended to resolve the case within the underlying limits.
Doesn't at least some of the evidence of your conduct prior to trial bear on whether or not you made a reasonable settlement? For example, if National Union didn't know anything about the lawsuit, how could it properly evaluate what was a reasonable settlement? Isn't that fair game on just causation of damages?
Well, I think not, because, of course, the causation inquiry is going to be irrelevant if there is no duty.
No, I'm talking about the causation of damages.
Well,
the amount of the settlement, just as you said going in, you think the inquiry will be, is there any difference between what you would have paid but for the negligence and what you actually paid? And isn't there some argument that you, even if Techmahan was negligent, you overpaid because you didn't properly evaluate or know enough to evaluate the lawsuit?
Well, as I understand the record, National Union, once the primary limits were tendered, National Union did retain another lawyer, Norm Snyder, to negotiate the settlement.
Over a period of how long?
Well, I think it was probably a couple of days.
Well, my point is, shouldn't the evidence of your lack of knowledge prior to those 2 days come in on whether you really did reasonably evaluate the settlement or have a reasonable basis for settlement?
Of course, the evaluation of National Union has to be judged from the time its duty arises and from the time the primary limits were tendered. And I think based upon what happened and the primary limits being tendered right there after trial had begun, and after the Wolf Point plaintiffs had made a $13 million demand, National Union basically goes at that from that moment on in terms of evaluating what the reasonable settlement would be. And until that time, I don't think that anything that National Union did prior to trial would have any bearing.
No, but if the argument is, you actually did pay $4 million more than the case was worth, and that's undisputed. Isn't the fact that the reason you paid $4 million more is because you weren't up to speed prior to trial, isn't that relevant to why you overpaid?
If it were true that the case was overpaid, and I don't believe there's any summary judgment evidence of that to this point, that the settlement was overpaid, it would be because of the defense of the case by the law firm and by INA's conduct. And I think that National Union is justified in not being necessarily informed about the details of the case based on the representations that were made to it by the primary carrier that the case would be resolved within the underlying limits.
Well, is there a distinction to be drawn between the duty to defend and the duty to monitor or to manage? In other words, let's say that there should have been a reservation of rights letter. Let's just take that as true. Would that have affected or had some impact on the value of the settlement? And if you had not reasonably or evaluated the case enough to send that reservation of rights, wouldn't that be relevant? Question.
I don't think that it is relevant.
Well, but as I understand, your argument is that because there's no duty to defend before tender the primary limits, you had no duty to do anything. But if we did recognize some sort of duty to manage or monitor, and that was the duty hook, then it would all come in. And why shouldn't we recognize such a duty?
Well, I can see where if the court were to establish a new duty in Texas, previously unrecognized, where an excess carrier would essentially take on qualities of a primary carrier in terms of investigation and monitoring, I can see where
We aren't dealing with a large body of Texas law here.
I understand
that. We're on a pretty clean slate with varying approaches in different jurisdictions that we could look to for guidance. So we're really asking a public policy question.
And
what is fairest to all parties concerned in the way you operate your business day to day? What makes the most sense so that when things go bad, losses are fairly allocated in a way that does not harm the normal operation of business of the majority of towns when they go right?
And let me put the issue just as hard as I think it can be put, which is everybody sits down before the disaster, and the lawyers say, and the primary carrier says, you need to know this, you need to know this, and you need to respond. And the excess carrier says, well, we don't have to pay any attention to any of that. We're not going to do any of those things. And we're going to sue you for malpractice as soon as this is all over with because we think you caused it. Then can that story not be told after the deal is done?
Now, I can see if that's what the facts of the case. If a primary carrier did make a demand upon an excess carrier to participate, to advise them of X, Y, and Z, this is what's going on, these are our problems. We think that there is a potential here, a high potential, that the excess layer is going to be pierced. There is a settlement demand from the plaintiffs of X amount, which is over the underlying limits. You know, do something.
But your position is you don't have a duty.
Well,
you don't have to do it.
If the court were to hold, as you're suggesting, if that were the rule, that doesn't justify reversal of the case here because those things didn't happen here. In fact, when the $3.6 million settlement demand was communicated to National Union in February, it's my recollection that INA did not make a response to it or did not make an offer.
The implication in that scenario, the implication in the hypothet is that the primary carrier is tendering the limits of their policy.
That's right.
And you would say, yeah.
Yeah.
Then we'd move into play.
Yeah, that would definitely be, an interpretation of what would happen by those events. That would essentially qualify as a tendering of the limits. And of course,
but let's assume the primary carrier says, well, you need to be aware they made a demand in excess of the primary limits, but we're not prepared to tender the limits of our policy, but we want you to participate now in this case and take on an obligation to be not negligent in failing to settle. What happens?
I think maybe in that instance, there may be some issues about contractual issues that arise out of the insurance, the nature of the excess insurance policy itself, and whether that is something that was bargained for, whether that's something that would be permitted or under the insurance policy itself. But I can see where if an excess insurer does in fact intervene, or not intervene, but take part and begin to participate in the negotiations or the investigation or monitoring of the suit and assumes a duty,
it doesn't assume a duty. It doesn't participate. It is just simply presented with a demand by the primary carrier to participate without the primary carrier's commitment to tender its own policy limits. What happens in the relationship?
And I think that an excess carrier would be reluctant I think that an excess carrier would not have a duty absent a formal tender of the limits in that instance.
Do you concede that an excess carrier can take actions or fail to take actions prior to the time of that formal tender that will affect the amount that it ultimately paid in a settlement?
I think in certain situations it's possible that can happen.
And if that happens, why should we have a rule that prohibits any of that information from coming into evidence in a subsequent malpractice suit?
I think the primary response to that is that it alters the nature of the equitable subrogation doctrine. It alters the nature of the excess primary relationship, and we have an excess insurer that starts to become essentially another primary carrier.
Take a minute then to describe for us what you think Texas law is, that just briefly summarize the nature of that relationship between the excess and the primary carrier, and what's contemplated by the whole structure in terms of the, you know, the cost of premiums,
right,
and what's provided and how that works, so that since we're making, looking at some public policy issues.
Right. Well, of course, an insurer like Granada would contract for primary insurance, you know, to cover third-party liability claims such as this, which would contract for defense and indemnity and so forth, but also contract for excess insurance over and above the certain underlying layer. Now, of course, the excess policy only provides that the excess insurer will, pay or take or assume the defense once the underlying limits have been tendered or exhausted. And the premiums paid for excess insurance justify that sort of expectation on the part of the insurer who expects the primary carrier to control and monitor the litigation in accordance with its defense duty, and also the expectations of the insurer who has not paid premiums that would justify an excess carrier's basically dual involvement with the primary carrier in the monitoring of the case and investigation of the case. And so if we were in fact to impose new independent duties on the part of an excess carrier, then I believe that we are moving towards excess carriers becoming some sort of surrogate primary carrier, and that will inevitably result in increased costs of obtaining excess coverage, and you will have, of course, in many occasions, multiple levels of excess insurers that will all be involved, and you'll have everyone's fingers in the pie. So.
Let me ask you quickly about the release. And it seemed to me in your brief there was a good bit of tension between the concept that this release should not be given much weight because it was an attorney who also partially owned the company and sat on the board of directors himself, dealing in with a scheme to get out of just liability on this suit, and then one or two pages later, if you don't buy that, this release never even contemplated this lawsuit. And it ought to be read as such because it only talked about cases where the fees weren't fully paid up as of the time, and so on. Which is it? And,
well, our primary position is that the release, or that the Wolf Point suit is not a matter that was clearly within the subject matter of the release, which is what the Court of Appeals held. The language of the release, I think, is being strained. I mean, the text is just straining to read this language to include the release, to include the Wolf Point suit, when Mr. Cook himself testified that the release did not cover the Wolf Point suit. And he said that in his deposition. And, of course, the representative of Granada, Mr. Eller, also testified that, in his view, the Wolf Point suit would not have been covered by this release.
Any other?
There is.
Okay. No, if you've got more, answer my question.
Well, there is. I mean, we do argue that there is some, that perhaps this was not necessarily an arm's length transaction because of the link between Granada and the Keck firm. And we've made that argument in the brief, but our first position is that the language itself just does not contemplate this suit and this matter, even if, and that additionally, because as Justice O'Neill was discussing, there was conduct, malpractice that occurred after April 1st of 92, which would also not be contemplated by the release as well.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. Would you give
counsel for INA 6 minutes.
Thank you. Thank you very much for the opportunity to speak for you today. I've got a limited amount of time. I'd like to hit a couple of points. I don't think that we have to radically change the law or change duties in Texas in order to assess an issue against an excess carrier for its own conduct. I think that Texas law is very clear that one owes a duty to oneself. The Shivers case and the confirmation of that in Highland Park, I think, clearly shows that an individual has a right, has an obligation, a duty to look over one's own house. It's separate and apart from any duty it owes to anyone else. I don't think we have to change the duty that an excess carrier owes to its insured in order to impose a duty on the excess carrier to simply manage its own affairs and manage its own affairs in a reasonable and prudent manner. I don't think it's dependent upon...
Well, it might be liable to itself for the seven or however the settlement amount of money it paid, but that's not the issue here. The issue here is whether or not someone else, whether or not they somehow are responsible to the primary carrier and the insured for conduct that occurred before the excess carriers, before the primary carrier tendered its balance. Does INA do any excess carrier, does it provide any excess carrier?
It's changed and bought and sold so many different companies that I'm sure it does.
So well, it seems to me your position is that a primary carrier need not tender its, exhaust its amount, need not do that to put upon the excess carrier the duty to participate in the defense of the lawsuit.
No, that's not what I'm saying. I'm saying that this would not impose any additional duties on the excess carrier, to either the primary carrier or its insurer, that do not already exist in Texas, which is simply for purposes of comparative or contributory negligence, that you look to the duty that one owes to oneself, just as the Shivers case clearly established, in that it's not that, now if there was a suit between Granada and the excess carrier, then all the defenses of MSCOR would be available to National Union as the excess carrier because those duties are clearly defined. But here in this case, we have an excess carrier suing with impunity, basically, without any consideration of its own conduct and whether it managed its affairs properly against both the primary carrier and the defense counsel that the insured hired to represent them in the underlying case. And in that instance, none of these duties that would go to the excess carrier would be expanded in any way. It would be simply following the tenets of law that one should look after one's own house. And in fact, if you're going to sue under an equitable subrogation cause of action such as this, that your conduct, you shouldn't be able to do it with impunity, as National Union fights so hard to do to protect against the laundry list of potential evidence that would come in as to their own comparative fault for the reason that they paid $6 million towards a $7 million settlement. That's the point that we're simply trying to make, and I think Chapter 33 supports that from the standpoint that they're clearly a claimant. The 1992 version of the Act applies in this particular case, and as a party, either suing potentially as the real party damaged for its own damages or suing on behalf of an injured party, then they are a claimant under 33.011.
We don't have a direct action here.
Pardon me?
We don't have a direct action by the excess carrier. The excess carrier is asserting an equitable subordination claim.
Correct.
So how does that fit with what you just told us?
Well, there's no, in Chapter 33, there is no exception for subrogation.
But equitable subordination is a fiction. National Union is standing in the shoes of its insured.
Correct. And in the difference, the distinction I see, Your Honor, is
so why aren't we looking to putting it in that position and treating it as the insured for purposes of deciding what defenses and obligations may exist?
Because I think it goes beyond mere ministerial subrogation, as I raised in my brief.
So you're asking us then to move away from the American Centennial holding that this is an equitable subordination action and look at the question of whether we should extend it to being a direct action.
I don't think American Centennial fully analyzed all of the ins and outs of an equitable subrogation cause of action between an excess carrier and a primary carrier. I think it was alluded to in the concurrence, the majority concurrence of the court, and all parties should have all defenses available to it.
Any available defenses?
Any available defenses, which I don't see to...
But I'm having a really hard time with the idea of getting around the equitable subordination construct, so that the conduct of National Union plays into this at all.
Because I'll agree with you certainly that this is a little different animal than what typically in a subrogation case, you have an auto accident or something, you pay property damage, and then you go after the responsible third party with no discretionary process.
And at that point in time when that occurs, can the defendant look to the conduct of the insurance company and the way it managed the claim and what it paid? In turn, they can't, can they?
No, because
what if the insurance carrier, you know, paid too much, didn't investigate properly, and paid too much?
Well, because
we look at that conduct, so the defendant can say, well, you may have paid your insured this amount of money, but it was too much because you weren't doing your job back there. We're going to look at your conduct. Do we ever look behind an action like that at the conduct of the insurance carrier, or do we look at the insurance conduct?
Well, in this instance, I think you have to because the insurer...
No, but in the ordinary equitable subordination action.
Well, you don't have a case that preceded the judgment where there's really damage to the insured. This is a discretionary decision on the part of the excess carrier to, through its own evaluation or lack of it, to pay $6 million as opposed to a judgment that's been rendered against its insured, potentially exposing insured to a situation where the insured itself suffers damages. And that's the distinction that I see between what has typically been subrogation law and is typically not a discretionary decision based upon an insurance carrier, be it primary or excess.
But if I'm an insurance carrier and my insured is injured in some way, and so I pay for the damages to my insured, and then I stand in the shoes of that insured to pursue the defendant who caused the harm, in an effort to recover what I paid, what the damages were. Do we ever get into the conduct of the insurance carrier in that context?
I don't think we do in almost all the instances, because usually that's not in dispute. It's not disputed as to what the primary carrier paid, be it medical or property. Here we have a discretionary decision. Here we have to look at to what went into that discretionary decision as opposed to simply waiting, seeing where the chips fell during the judgment, and then taking action accordingly.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Let me go back to the questions from the court about whether to permit the introduction of the full spectrum of National Union's conduct would increase any duties, create any new duties, or add to those that currently exist as to an excess carrier. I neglected to mention earlier that Article 21 of the Insurance Code and 2121-2, as well as the provisions in the Texas Administrative Code, impose on all insurance companies, making no distinction between excess and primary, the obligation to analyze coverage and notify the insured of coverage defenses if they exist. Those same provisions impose on all insurance companies the duty to investigate and to communicate with insurers about settlement decisions.
Looking at the public policy reasons we've been talking about, do you agree with Mr. Jewell's characterization of the relationship between excess and primary insurance in Texas?
To some degree, Your Honor, although I would...
How would you characterize it, since that's part of the underpinning of the public policy considerations here?
I think the important thing is to consider the fact that the excess carrier is playing with the insured's right and the insured's money.
No, but I asked him specifically if he would characterize what the nature of excess coverage is vis-a-vis the primary and how it works. Do you agree with him, or do you think there is a different characterization that should be put on how it works?
Well, I think that for purposes of the policy, which is protecting the insurance benefits available to the insured, the situation from a primary, the primary insurance is that first layer of protection. The excess insurance obviously is the next layer of protection. Now, to the extent...
You're buying something different when you buy primary coverage versus when you buy excess. What are you buying when you buy primary as compared to what you're buying when you buy excess?
When you buy primary insurance, you're buying the services from the primary insurance carrier to provide a defense where the policy provides for that, as well as often the opportunity by the primary carrier to take responsibility for negotiation of settlement. Now, when you buy excess insurance, you're buying additional layers of protection. But in this situation, as in many, the excess policies are so often triggered, and the excess insurer...
But what else do you get besides the excess coverage that kicks in once the primary layer is exhausted? What else do you get at the point in time a claim arises underneath these policies?
Well, once the primary is exhausted, the excess carrier owes the duty to defend and the duty to settle.
Well, but at the time the claim arises under the respective policies at each layer, what is the insured getting from the excess carrier at that point in time?
If the court's question is in terms of a duty owed, the duty is first owed by the primary carrier, but with respect to the fact that the excess carrier is managing a benefit that the insured has purchased.
Are the premium structures for primary and excess comparable?
No, they're not.
And why is that?
They're different because the primary carrier pays the cost of defense. That is the most important distinction. I disagree with Mr. Jewell's suggestion that to admit this evidence will drive up the cost of premiums. That simply is not true. But the other big difference between the pricing and the premiums between primary and excess is frankly because the excess carriers have a more remote expectation that their policy proceeds will be capped. That's the biggest component of the difference in cost.
So if you're going to now require excess carriers to monitor discovery, monitor trial, isn't that going to drive up the cost of excess insurance?
I respectfully say that it will not, Your Honor, for these reasons. Already, under the Insurance Code, Article 21, excess carriers, as well as primary carriers, have some duty to pay attention. They cannot completely ignore correspondence coming from defense counsel. Moreover, the duty that we are suggesting that the excess carrier have and take responsibility for is to simply be aware of its own policy and whether these claims were covered under its own policy and to respond to settlement demands within its layer.
What difference does it make in terms of, as between the excess carrier and the law firm, whether they're covered or not? If the excess carrier stands in the shoes of the insured is surely liable without regard to coverage. What difference does it make?
Well, it makes this difference because the excess carrier is seeking to recover that money from the back of the law firm. And if indeed the excess carrier...
Which the insured would have to pay if there was no coverage.
True. That's true. But in this case, the theory of Tech Main and Kate is that the excess carrier, to the extent that it contends it paid more than it should have, the argument is it paid more than it should have because it was concerned of its own excess liability.
Your argument is it should have denied coverage and left the insured hanging out for the judgment.
Your Honor, whether it should have denied coverage is something for the jury to determine. But if indeed National Union did not, if its policy did not cover these claims, as we think it did not, then that's correct. And the issue would be between Granada and its lawyer to the extent the lawyer committed any malpractice. But it's incorrect to permit the excess carrier to say, It was all the fault of the law firm when the excess carrier was motivated to pay more than it thinks it should have to protect itself from the liability of the excess judgment.
Let me ask you a question, Mr. Renfro. It strikes me that what you're saying is there was negligence in the settlement process. We've said very clearly any number of times the only duty that's out there is a Stowers. Well, maybe the excess carrier ought to have a Stowers duty. But that duty, we've clearly said, isn't implicated until there's a demand within policy limits. And the analogy to an excess carrier would be when the excess carrier knows that it is now on the hook, meaning the primaries offered theirs, and the case has not settled, and now here's a demand that's being made within the excess carrier's limits. Seems to me there's a duty to settle. If we don't hinge the excess carrier's duty on that kind of clear rule like we have on the primary, it seems to me we've created a different obligation of an insurance company to its insurer. Now explain to me how we can impose a duty on the excess carrier similar to Stowers, which is what you're asking, without the same bright line rule that we have for the primary carrier.
In this case, Your Honor, National Union was on notice from November of 1991, as the court can see from the chronology in Petitioner's Exhibit 2. It was on notice from November of 1991 that the first settlement demand was well within its length. The settlement demands never went down.
But the primary carrier had not tendered its amount, which the agreement between the excess and the primary is that you either have to exhaust or tender.
That's true. It had not tendered. And there's culpability there that we think a jury should hear about. But the result is, if the court does not permit the introduction of the evidence of National Union, while from the time frame that it had noticed that this claim was going to fall within its limits, and if the court does not allow the jury to know that National Union's own examiner had indicated in his file that the excess policy was going to be implicated, those are facts that occurred even before tender. If the jury is not allowed to hear those things, they cannot arrive at the proper loss causation analysis. And the result, I think, statewide will be, the result is to condone a tactic by an insurance company of sleep, settle, and sue with no consequences whatsoever for the conduct that occurred pre-tender. The fact that the tender, the date of tender, such an arbitrary act by the primary carrier over which the excess may have no control, the law firm has no control, and the client, the insured, has no control. That fact cannot be used to draw the line in the sand as to when a party's conduct may be considered by the jury in loss causation and when it cannot.
Any other questions? Thank you. That concludes the argument.